Brought to you by On Service Oriented Architecture, part of the On Podcast Network at Inform IT.
Welcome back, everyone, to the On SOA podcast series brought to you by Pearson Education. Today, we're continuing our discussion of SOA design principles with best-selling SOA author Thomas Earle, who is editor of the Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle. So, Thomas, last we left off with service reusability as a principle, and today I have that we are going to be discussing service autonomy, service statelessness, service discoverability, and service composability. Can you remind our listeners of the website where they can follow along?
Yes. If you could please go to soaprinciples.com, you'll see a navigation pane on the left side where it says Service Orientation Design Principles. There is one called Service Autonomy. That's the next one in line for what we'll be talking about. And we'll get into the details of that and the remaining principles today.
Excellent.
So let's keep going. So last time we talked about reusability, we talked about how we combine commercial product techniques with enterprise-specific considerations and how that forms a specific approach to designing highly reusable services, almost as standalone products in their own right, but products for a specific market, that being the clients of the organization that the IT enterprise is there to support. So to make services as reusable as possible and to make them as recomposable as possible, because a lot of the considerations that service orientation brings up have to do with positioning services as highly composable resources. To put all that in place, one of the fundamental parts that we have to have, a fundamental characteristic that our implementation has to have, is a high or a significant extent of autonomy. We want to have the service environment, we want to give it as much control over its execution environment as possible, which means minimizing dependency on shared resources. So we have issues that we may have to deal with. A service may encapsulate invoice-related processing, but to access invoice data, it may need to connect to a central database that is shared by all kinds of different environments within the enterprise as well. That shared database may represent a concern because at some peak usage points, the service itself might have to wait in line or might have delayed queries or whatever the case may be. It'll introduce lag time, which translates into a decrease in the predictability of the service behavior. And
okay.
So what service autonomy is about is maximizing the predictability of service behavior. And so there are different design patterns, in fact, that can be applied. Service data replication is one of them that can overcome this shared database scenario. But overall, what we look to do is create as much of an isolated environment as possible for each service, not necessarily physically isolated. In some cases it is, but just to give it as much control as possible and then perform as predictably as possible. The diagram you see here on this page is talking about how in a service composition, you actually naturally lose autonomy. If you have a composition where you have, let's say, a task service at the head of the composition hierarchy, it needs to compose two other services, which themselves need to compose other services to carry out their logic, then you automatically lose autonomy as you go up that hierarchy. The least autonomous part of that environment could be the task service, which has dependencies on other services, which have dependencies on others. The most autonomous parts of that composition are those utility services on the bottom, because from what we can see here, they don't have dependencies on any other services. They're in their own environments, not composing any other services. But we're interested in the composition design, the composition architecture as a whole. So when we look at this and we understand how autonomy changes and is affected when we compose services together, that amplifies the need for, or emphasizes the need for, maximizing the autonomy of individual services. Because once we put them into a composite, the composition, then is going to be dependent on the collective autonomy of the individual services. So if you have one service there that has a very low autonomy, it will then become a weak link in the chain, and then will affect the overall autonomy of the composition. So with that knowledge, with that foreknowledge, we design services to be as autonomous as possible so that we can create robust compositions and recompose services as we need to, which is a natural part of building service-oriented solutions. So loss of autonomy is natural and expected. except I'll just make one caveat to that. There is a design pattern called composition autonomy in which you actually isolate a whole composition, but that's a special case which you don't necessarily have to apply to every situation. But in general, loss of autonomy is natural, and we prepare for that loss by maximizing the autonomy of individual services so that ultimately the loss is as little as possible. We lose as little as possible later on when we compose them together.
Excellent.
So let's move on to service statelessness. If you'd like to click the link on the left side there. This basically has to do, it's not about creating purely stateless services. It has to do with minimizing the period of time that services remain in an unnecessarily stateful condition. So you have different services doing different things, different service capabilities doing different things, in fact, because services are, in essence, just containers of individual functions. And there often is a requirement, especially in a composition, for a service to retrieve information, hold it in memory, wait for other services to complete their parts of the composition, and then when everything's done, it destroys that information. What this design principle advocates is that where appropriate, the information that services hold in memory can be deferred or delegated to another part of the architecture. So maybe a database, maybe an intentionally stateful system service, which ties into another design pattern called stateful services. Whatever the case may be, you remove data from memory that doesn't have to be there or that you expect will be there for a prolonged period of time, in order to minimize the overall resource consumption of the service on the enterprise. So what this design principle is primarily concerned with is service scalability. We want to maximize the amount of service instances that we can spawn for any given service so that we have a larger threshold. The larger the threshold, the more service instances we can support. The less each service instance consumes in memory, the more service instances we can have. The more instances we can have, the more scalable the service, the more it can be reused by different types of compositions for different reasons, and the more we get out of our infrastructure as a whole. It may seem like, when you look at it just from an individual service basis, it may not seem like a big deal if the service uses up a bit of memory for a few extra seconds here and there.
Okay.
But you have to look at the big picture and think about how any one service, especially the agnostic ones, can be reused by different service compositions in support of different business tasks, and each one of those business tasks may have different instances being invoked. You might have different users carrying out the same task concurrently. So you have a service being used by different compositions. Each composition might create multiple instances of the same service. So all of a sudden, one bit of memory consumption that it requires can compound into 100 times that if there are that many instances that are being concurrently used. And in larger, more serious service-oriented environments where you have large service inventories, that level of concurrency is not unusual, depending on the nature of the logic. So we prepare for that. We want our environment to be as scalable as possible. We never want to reach a threshold where all of a sudden everything comes to a grinding halt because we've reached some peak usage and we now have to figure out what to do with that. So we prepare for that by tuning this part of the service and positioning it as a more optimized software program that is part of that collective in the service inventory.
Okay.
So let's go over to service discoverability. And this is another design principle that some organizations take less seriously, but that can often be a mistake, again, especially in larger environments. The service discoverability principle has to do with maximizing the quality, the communications quality, of all the information we publish about a service. So in the past, you've had technical interfaces for various types of programs and legacy systems and components and so on, and they were very technical in nature. They were intended for either just for use within a project or they were intended to be used by peers, usually other developers. And so they were very terse and sometimes cryptic and not a lot of other information necessarily there to help you understand what a particular program does or what your expectations should be. In an SOA environment, you have services that you put out there that you want the rest of the world to use. You want them to be reused because that's what gives you that ROI and that's what makes the whole environment more streamlined and avoids redundancy and all those things we talked about before. In order for that to happen, others need to be able to interpret the service, understand how it gets used, but they also need to be able to find it, which ties into the whole discovery aspect of it. So for that to happen effectively, for complete strangers to locate your service and then understand what it does, the service contract and any other information you publish about a service, which can include an SLA or the service registry records, any other information you publish about a service has to be clear. And often, not always, but often, the people that build the services are not good at communicating what the service can do to others who are not their peers. So essentially making it very clear to even less technical people, like project managers sometimes tend to be, who still need to discover and understand services that they're required to use to improve the communications quality of whatever is published. So that's what this design principle is about, and it's something we take into consideration while the service is being designed, because that is when all that knowledge is there. Project teams can get split up. They can go different ways. You might have consultants that are part of a team that aren't there next month because they're working for a different company. You have to document as part of the service profile that you maintain throughout a service's lifespan. You have to document the nature of the service and what it's all about, and communicate that very clearly, and then publish that information so that it's as easy to understand as possible. If you do not, you introduce the risk that the service will either not be discovered or will be misunderstood or misinterpreted when it is discovered, and that other project teams will inadvertently build similar services or similar type of functionality, thereby denormalizing the service inventory, introducing redundancy, and then undermining some of our strategic goals. So even though this may seem like we're focusing on cosmetic or aesthetic things, like naming conventions or just explaining things in a very clear manner, it's really important because you have, especially in large environments, people from all walks of life trying to work together with the same inventory.
Okay.
Right. So sometimes the project teams will actually involve a technical writer or some sort of communication specialist to take over what's published about a service and just reword it so that it is as clear as possible.
Mm.
So, okay, we'll move on to the last principle now, which in a way you could argue that it is the most important one. The interesting thing about some of these principles, which we haven't talked about before, is the fact that the application of some of them tend to result in more concrete design characteristics being implemented, and the application of others also result in design characteristics being implemented within the service, but they also act as regulatory influences, making sure that some of the other principles are applied to the extent that they need to be, and this is a good example of one. One of the biggest requirements ultimately for a service is that it be positioned as a highly effective composition participant. So we may deliver a service initially. It may only need to be part of a simple composition, maybe involving two other services to complete some initial task. And it might do that very, very well. But if we do not take this particular consideration into account, when another project comes along and wants to pull that same service into its composition, and its composition is larger or more complex or different in some way, the service itself may not be effective at participating in that composition. It might have certain limitations performance-wise or autonomy-wise, or it might impose certain things that weaken the composition as a whole. And fundamental to the success of SOA is for services to be as composable and especially as recomposable as possible, so that we can repeatedly leverage them, pull them into different composition configurations, and fulfill different business requirements, automate different business processes or changing business processes, continually do that for a long period of time. So what we attempt to do here with this design principle is establish the services up front as being highly effective composition participants. And that takes into consideration many of the design principles we talked about before, but it requires that they collectively be applied to a certain measure where we can comfortably say, you know what, this is now at a point where it will be highly composable regardless of the other types of compositions that may need to involve it. It's not just specific to this immediate set of needs. And it introduces different levels, and the whole description of this principle has different ways of measuring that. So this is a core consideration, a core requirement that a service needs sort of to pass in order to be considered a high-quality body of service-oriented logic. And it also ties into one of the fundamental design patterns that is part of the service design pattern language in the SOA Design Patterns book, where there we have a design pattern language that leads up. It has various steps that define services from one point to another, and then ultimately there's a pattern that is called service recomposition, where it's not just about service composition, but it's the repeated composition that the service needs to facilitate, and that ties directly into supporting this particular principle. So if you're interested in that pattern, have a look at soapatterns.org. So in a way, all of the application of design principles for service orientation all kind of build up to the application of this one. And then when we get to a point where we have the confidence of knowing that it can fulfill all of the standard requirements as well as be repeatedly effective composition member or participant, then we've produced a quality service, which is what service orientation is all about.
Thomas, thank you for that thorough and interactive overview. Extremely, very rich content. Thank you. Speaking of valuable URLs, let me just quickly ask you about soaglossary.com. Is this essentially just an online glossary with definitions for SOA-related terms?
Yeah, pretty much. It was primarily published as a resource for the book series as a whole. We have all these books coming out soon. We'll have over 10 books. And instead of redundantly publishing a glossary in every book, I decided to put a glossary up online, have it support all the books, but also it's been online now for over half a year. I've seen it and heard from people who use it in academic circles and in the vendor communities as well. It's become somewhat of a community resource, I guess you could call it. We're going to be adding new terms to it on a regular basis. There's still a lot on our list to add, but over time I'm hoping that it'll have several hundred terms up there, and we'll provide just a convenient way of looking up terms that might be new to you or that you want some clarification for.
Super. Thank you again, Thomas. For all of our listeners out there, to learn more about the SOA Principles book, please visit soabooks.com, where you can also get free sample chapters and you can download a pretty cool color poster for free. The SOA Principles book is the third title in the Prentice Hall Service-Oriented Computing series from Thomas Earle, and his upcoming SOA Design Patterns book will be the fourth title. And as Thomas just mentioned, there's five other books in the works about to publish in 2008. So exciting times for SOA and books. Thank you again, Thomas, and we thank all of our listeners out there. Hope you learned something. We're sure you did. And we'll talk to you later. Thank you. Bye-bye.